When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. In the early 2000s, there was this trend in nonfiction called the experiential memoir, where an author would go off and do a thing for a year and write about it. You had Julie and Julia, a memoir by Julie Powell chronicling her experience cooking all the recipes from Julia Child's cookbook in a year. There was Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver, in which she and her family moved to a farm to spend a year eating locally grown food. And of course, you had Eat, Pray, Love, where Elizabeth Gilbert trotted the globe, finding herself and falling in love over the course of a year. At the top of that heap was an author named A.J. Jacobs. Whereas other authors dabbled in the experiential memoir, he has made it an entire brand. His book, The Know-It-All, came out in 2004, the year I graduated high school and went on to college. It had a profound impact on me, as on its surface, it was simply a book about a man who challenged himself to read the entire Encyclopedia Britannica in a year and write about the experience. But underneath the text, I found a nuanced work that asked big questions like, what even is knowledge? What is wisdom? And is knowing a lot of stuff equal to either of those things? He went on to great acclaim with his follow-up book, The Year of Living Biblically, where he spent a year following the Bible as literally as possible. Jacobs has gone on to write about scientific experimentation, wellness, genealogy, gratitude, puzzles, and this year, in a timely publication, his book, The Year of Living Constitutionally, followed him as he tried to unpack what the Constitution is, why it matters, and whether it's a good thing that the United States allows a document that is hundreds of years old and written during a time when leeches were the height of medicine to influence our lives today. I kept my cool, or tried to, as I interviewed one of my literary heroes, not just on the Constitution, but on the concept of expertise, curiosity, and how to be a constant learner. You guys, here's A.J. Jacobs. A.J. Jacobs, welcome to Head on Fire. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted.
So for people who don't know you or your work, though that means they've never listened to an episode of my show, tell people who you are and what it is that you do.
Well, first, thank you for having me. I'm very excited. I am a writer, a nonfiction writer. And what I usually do is I take a topic and I immerse myself in it. I try something out for a year, sometimes shorter, sometimes longer. I was interested in religion, so I wrote a book called The Year of Living Biblically, where I followed all the rules of the Bible, the Ten Commandments, but also growing a huge beard and not wearing clothes made of two different kinds of fabric, all, which is forbidden in the Bible. I did one about gratitude, where I went around the world and thanked 1,000 people who had anything to do with my morning cup of coffee. Because it takes the globe to make the coffee, the farmers and the baristas and the truck drivers and the road builders and on and on. So that's sort of the genre that I love.
And your most recent book is The Year of Living Constitutionally, a book that I have held and read and enjoyed, and it sits alongside my A.J. Jacobs shelf of other A.J. Jacobs books.
Thank you, Don. Thank you.
Oh, of course. What made you want to tackle the Constitution in an election year?
Well, exactly. I mean, when I proposed the book to my publisher, they said, yes, but you got to get it out now.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was not, when I said a year of living constitutionally, it was a year of living and writing and, you know, I was on the Ben Franklin schedule, waking up at 5 a.m. to write with my quill pen, by the way. So, yeah, this came about just because I read a statistic a couple of years ago. 60% of Americans have not read the Constitution. I was one of those 60%. And yet every day the Constitution was on the front page of the news and has a huge impact on our lives. How everything from where we go to school or what women can do with their bodies, what men can do with their bodies, religion and guns. And so I was like, I got to do this. And it seemed particularly timely because it was an election year. And also the Supreme Court has embraced the five of the nine justices believe in something called originalism, where you have to try to ascertain the original meaning of what the words meant in 1789. And I thought, okay, that's a good challenge. I'm going to try to do that. And I'm going to try to go back in my mind into 1789. And not just in my mind. I put on a tricorn hat. I got an 18th century musket that I carried around New York City where I live. I quartered soldiers in my apartment. I did the whole thing. And
you made election cake.
I made election cake. Yes, thank you. And I'm doing it again this year. And I'm happy to talk about it. It was one of my favorite parts of the project.
That it was a pretty magical part. People, what did you say? That cake has no affiliation.
Cake
crosses party lines.
That's it. Cake goes, right. It rises above factions. Everyone is pro cake, I think, or should be.
So what did you, I mean, What'd you think of it? You've read it now. What'd you think of the Constitution?
Well, it's a fascinating document because parts of it are some of the most inspiring words I've ever read. Like the preamble. I love the preamble. The we the people. First of all, just that phrase, we the people. Mm-hmm. Amazing. And it talks about the general welfare and the blessings of liberty and equal protection under the law. So that's is the most amazing words. On the other hand, it is a flawed document. And they knew that when they wrote it, that George Washington wrote his nephew. He said, this is a flawed document. You're going to have to improve it. I mean, even down to the spelling, there are a bunch. I ran it through Grammarly software and Grammarly found 600 mistakes, which I think is a little much. But there are things like the word Pennsylvania is spelled two different ways in the Constitution, P-E-N-N and P-E-N. So it was not meant to be perfect. It was meant to always be improved. And that was one of the big takeaways, that we have to keep working to improve the Constitution. Because, as you know, the Constitution was written by 55 white men, and some of them were slave owners. And so we have thankfully progressed since then, but we've got to keep going and keep pushing to make it more and more perfect.
I didn't realize until your book, though, that it is signed by one woman. Yes?
Oh, is it?
At the bottom of the document.
Right, exactly. That is hilarious. Yes, but she was not an official signer, but she was sort of worked for the printer, if I remember correctly. But yes, and also women could vote in New Jersey for about 10 years in 1790. But overall, not a great time for women. So despite those exceptions.
Do you think any of them are hiding treasure maps to any great pile of gold anywhere?
Well, my previous book was about puzzles. So I'm always on the lookout for puzzles. I did not find any treasure. I don't want to ruin the ending, but the treasure I found was democracy. How's that? How's that for spinning it?
It's the democracy we found along the way. So exactly. after your year of research, did you give more thought to scrapping it all like France has done, or chipping away at it, trying to improve it with further amendments? Did you ever, you know? Or maybe since the publishing of it, have you come to a decision as to which one you think would be best?
Well, I do. I think we need more amendments. I am a huge fan of amendments, but they're so hard to pass. There hasn't been one since 1992, and just the thought of
it was a little bit of a loophole, as that wasn't a brand new amendment. That was one that was surviving for hundreds of years,
You know, that was one. James Madison. Yeah.
Yeah, guy got it through on spite, which personally, gotta say, I've done a lot of, I think I have a writing career because of spite. So I'm all for it.
It has its opposite, it has its positives. And just to explain that very quickly, this guy wrote a paper as a student at the University of Texas saying that there was this amendment James Madison proposed way back when that about how Congress cannot give itself a raise. It has to give a raise to the next Congress. And he said, it's still alive if we get 3/4 of the state legislatures to say, yes, this could be an actual amendment. His teacher gave him an F on the paper. So out of spite, as you say, Don, he went and spent the next 10 years getting it passed. But anyway, I am a big fan of amendments, but they're just so hard to pass. There are people on both the left and the right who say, let's scrap it. Let's do a reboot, a completely new constitution. That makes me nervous because who knows what'll come out in the end. But it is a problem that it's so hard to amend. So that is partly why we've resorted to changing the interpretation. So something like the 14th Amendment, when it was written in the 1860s, it guaranteed equal protection under the law. They were thinking of black men as who it was designed for. They were not thinking about women or LGBTQ plus people. They weren't thinking about gay marriage. But as we've progressed as a society, some, including me, think that that has to be expanded to include people to include women or gay people.
You know, I really enjoyed the book. There are folks out there who simply dealing with any topic of government or, you know, politics, especially this particular election, they just can't handle it. They can't participate in it. They don't even want to, give brain space to it just because it upsets them so deeply. And I understand that to a large extent. But do you have any advice for people that are simply so frustrated with government that they can't or don't want to engage with these topics?
Well, I'll tell you one thing I find incredibly helpful, which is to look at politics and the rest of life as a puzzle. Yeah, I look at politics as a puzzle. So if I'm in conversation with someone on the other side of the political spectrum, my default is to get really angry, to try to battle them with facts and statistics and show them, you know, who's right. That does not generally work, I have found. Instead, it just people polarize. They just get defensive and angrier. So I have switched tactics, and instead I try to see the conversation as a puzzle. So the puzzle is, why does she believe what she believes? Why do I believe what I believe? Is there any evidence that either of us could present to change the other mind? Is there... And if not, what can we do? Is there anything we can agree on and move forward in a productive way? And that is so, then it becomes almost a cooperative adventure and a mystery, you know, because it is mysterious why people, at least I find, why people would believe in QAnon. What, that is a crazy mystery. So let's try to get to the bottom of it. And that, it's not going to work all the time or even most of the time, but I do think it has a better chance of working in terms of changing minds a little, and just in terms of your own happiness, because otherwise you're in a state of rage all the time, and that's not good for you or anyone.
Though I will say, apparently it does make you very productive. I had a researcher on last year on the show who talked about whose research said that anger makes you more productive and actually better at decision making.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm going to have to look into that.
I'll send you the episode. Her research was fascinating. It was a team of researchers that said that anger makes you more productive and better at decision making. Though that, you know, it can of course go too far. But it was like, oh, that's why it's, you know, it's why I'm that so productive is... with all the spite.
Yes. Well, that, you know, as you know, that's how the guy passed that amendment, was out of anger and spite. Yes, that is possible. It'd be interesting to see the research and see how angry I get about the research that, and see if I
Oh, there you go. The year of living angrily. There.
That's, I have actually thought a lot about anger, and because I am not a fan of anger, which is why I'm particularly interested in this study, which says it does have its upsides sometimes. But yeah, overall,
it's one of those weird evolutionary holdover. It has an evolutionary purpose, like a lot of things. I'm particularly interested because I'm currently writing a book right now about the loneliness epidemic. So I'm interested in how, you know, all of these feelings are evolutionary byproducts. Like loneliness actually is a purposeful emotion, like hunger. Hunger tells us to seek out food. Thirst tells us to seek out hydration. Loneliness tells us to seek out other people. So it was incidental to the research, but I had to have her on.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, I would say that it sometimes serves a purpose, but often it is, you know, it's the whole idea.
Oh, sure, too much of anything. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's also that we're programmed to go into a state of rage and our heart rate goes up and our adrenaline goes up, which was good when you were trying to run away from a tiger, but not so good when you're waiting in line at Duane Reade Pharmacy and they're taking too long. So that doesn't help the line go faster.
You know, so much of your work, especially so many of the books that people know of, or associate you with immediately, you know, like you mentioned, The Year of Living Biblically, The Know-It-All, your research on the humanity's collective family tree. So much of your work asks us whether it is wise to reach to the past and allow it to inform our present, what those limitations are, and where innovation or evolution is necessary. So in that spirit, when applying what you learned about the founding of our country, do you think most modern people actually care about documents like the Constitution or the Bible themselves? Or are we all fighting over the idea of the Constitution or the Bible?
Now that is interesting. I think that, well, certainly there's a lot of motivated reasoning going on. Like people see what they want to see in the Constitution. And I actually got that myself. Not that my book on the Bible was like the Bible or the Constitution. Just want to put that out there. But I did have similar reactions in that, because I tried to show the good and the bad of religion. And I got lots of emails from religious people saying, thank you for showing me the good parts of faith and renewing my faith. And just as many from secular or atheist agnostic people saying, thanks for showing how crazy the Bible is. So we all look at it in our own way. I will say, in terms of the past, I love that you see that as a theme in my books, because now that you mention it, that's absolutely true. And I think my thought is the past is good and bad. There are good parts to the past and there are terrible parts. I mean, on the one hand, it was racist, sexist, homophobic. Cutting edge medicine in the 18th century was the tobacco smoke enema, where you literally, the doctor would blow smoke up your ass. That was where the phrase probably comes from, blow smoke up your ass. And it was thought really healthy, cures all sorts of ailments. So we don't want to go back to that. On the other hand, there are elements and ideas in from 18th century, like self-sacrifice, like thinking about the community, like, you know, and virtue and slowing down your thinking. Like when I was writing it with a quill pen instead of online, that changed the way my mind worked in a good way, I think, because I wasn't in a constant state of reaction to the latest news or the latest baldness cure ad that popped up on my computer. So, yeah, my argument is the past is mostly bad, I would say. Mostly bad. We don't want to go back. But there are elements from the past that can inspire us to be better.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works. This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
Yeah, I think that we have this idea with religion, with politics, with whatever, you know, that the founders, that whoever wrote the Bible, whoever organized the Bible, like all of those people knew something that we didn't, you know, that there's something more than human. And I think that we forget that all of these people are just people and they're just as fallible as anybody else. And that so much of the language used is appropriate for the day. And, you know, it could be hundreds or thousands of years old, and idealizing it or idolizing it at all is itself a fallacy.
Right. You don't want to commit idolatry on the Bible itself or on the Constitution. But at the same time, you know, there are wonderful things in the Constitution. And I do think it's interesting because you can look at the Constitution either as the big bang of democracy, like a huge step forward in human society, or as the work of slaveocracy, a bunch of 55 white men, some of them who are slave owners, trying to keep their elitist. And my argument, it's not mine alone, other scholars agree, it can be both. It is both. It is like in quantum physics, which I totally don't understand, but that things can be a particle and a wave at the same time. The Constitution can be a document of democracy and freedom at the same time as being an elitist document. And we have to be the ones who engage with it and try to bring out the good parts, the freedom parts, the equal opportunity parts.
If it makes you feel any better, I've had two different quantum physicists on the show, and they both told me that real quantum physicists don't understand quantum physics.
Oh, that's good.
And that the only people who pretend like they have a grasp on it, like that, you know, that they just really understand it and that they can apply it to all of these mundane things, are people who do not understand quantum physics.
I love to hear that. Yes, that does make me feel a lot better.
Yeah,
and so actually,
the experts in quantum physics don't even understand quantum physics.
Good. That makes me very happy. And I will say that is, not to bring it back to, that is a big theme in this new book and also other books, this idea of epistemic humility within, like that we don't know. There's so much we don't know and so much we can learn. And I love Ben Franklin, my favorite founding father, said the older he gets, the less certain he is of his own opinions. And I think that is wonderful as I approach his age, as I'm getting there way faster than I want.
Yeah, you know, I think no matter which modern aisle, no matter which modern end of the political spectrum that you fall on, I think any reading of the founding fathers' statements around the formation of the country, around the formation of these founding documents, I don't think that just about anybody can come away from a reading of that and think that this was supposed to be fixed forever and we were always supposed to live like we were in the 1700s.
Yeah, no, they were very forward-looking, entrepreneurial, and Jefferson, who obviously has huge flaws, but he was kind of the more radical. He said that we should have a new constitution every 19 years. Mm-hmm. I can't remember how he settled on 19, but that was, I guess, every generation. So yeah, and I agree. They were definitely they were forward looking and past looking a little, but they definitely wanted to evolve.
Yeah, that, of course, that's a time frame that seems to be settled on by a lot of people. The Supreme Court justices, there's a idea floating around that Supreme Court justices should be rotated out every, 12 to 18 years, something like that. I think that's the
time frame. I'm all for it. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Forever. Like, we're living a very long time now.
Exactly.
I don't want people who were alive before bread was commercially sliced to be making my laws about, I don't know, artificial intelligence. I just feel like those two things are not.
Right. I barely understand the internet or what my computer or anything. So yeah, the fact that like an 83-year-old would be able to have anything to say about it is, yeah, it's scary.
So I want to get into kind of the nature of it has long inspired me, and I know that inspires a lot of people because you tackle a lot of different kinds of subjects, which is something that I try to do as well. So I'm just curious, what drives your sense of curiosity?
Well, I'm glad you're curious about my curiosity, because that is the key, curiosity. I love curiosity, and I do think it can be cultivated somewhat. Partly it is to remind myself that anything can be fascinating, any topic can be fascinating. I once interviewed Alex Trebek, the late great Jeopardy host. I was interviewing for a magazine, Esquire magazine, and he said this quote that I think of all the time, and it doesn't really make sense, but it does to me. He said, "I'm curious about everything, even those things that I'm not interested in." And I thought that was lovely, because I think any topic, I've often thought maybe in my next book, I should do some stereotypically boring topic, like accounting, like a year of accounting, and see how interesting I could make it. Because I believe if you scratch under the surface of accounting, it is going to be fascinating, because it's not just about numbers. It's those numbers represent people and their hopes and their dreams and the way they spend their lives, and it's going to be fascinating. So just reminding yourself that, you know, humans are so complicated and so interesting that there's so much to learn, and we live such a short time that just why not dive in?
See, I think if you're looking for ideas, I would love to see you take a year and try to become a social media influencer. I think it would be... there are children's play sets now where they are buying social media influencer children's play sets with like a fake tripod and like a...
Are you serious?
Yes.
That is
one of the top five jobs that kids want these days is social media star.
That is remarkable.
I think it would be fascinating to,
you will have to
hear
me,
your take.
You would have to be one of my gurus if I undertake that. You can lead me through it. You're right. It would be a fascinating one. And maybe now, because my kids are about to go to college, so... Because they would be humiliated by that attempt.
I know, that's what would be so funny.
Yeah, it's true.
Are you ever intimidated by? I mean, my goodness, you have taken on. You've taken on the Bible. You've taken on the Torah. You've taken on knowledge itself. You've taken on history. And is there any topic that intimidates you?
Oh, yeah. Well, those topics all intimidated me. I mean, I deal with fear
the
time.
Okay, well, you handled it well.
Well, thank you. I mean, a lot of it is the strategy I use where I act as if I'm not afraid, even though I'm terrified, which is a big theme in all of my books, sort of the fake it till you feel it. I remember when I was writing about health and... You know, it was called Drop Dead Healthy, and it was about trying to be the most healthy person alive. And I would wake up really overwhelmed because, A, I'm not a doctor, and B, there's so much to learn. So I would feel this, you know, I would wake up sort of anxious and depressed, but I would act as if I were confident and optimistic. I would call the best doctors in the world, and I would call my publisher and say, all right, so for the party, the book party, we'll have kale martinis and this and that, and pretending that I was like, oh, I'm going to finish this.
And did they say, sure, get back to us after the book, after your year is over. We'll circle back on that one.
Yeah, probably. They probably didn't even answer the phone is what they did. But yeah, anyway, it was, so that is one secret. I am like constantly intimidated, but I try to overcome it by almost taking on the character of someone who is brave. And then you become a little braver. And once you act in a certain way for long enough, you do become more like that.
I'm struck by, you know, the whole, your ethos of fake it till you make it, you know, because like you talked about earlier, you're not a doctor, yet you're trying to become the healthiest person alive. You know, you're not a constitutional scholar, yet you took on the Constitution, you know, and so on and so forth. For people who are curious about a subject, I think we are in an era now where misinformation and disinformation has caused people to, you know, there is this push because we have all of the world's knowledge at our fingertips to do your own research, that you could potentially do your own research. And yet there is so much bad information out there. I mean, we just a couple of weeks ago saw some very bad information about how Google's AI was telling people that how to make a pizza required glue.
Glue in the crust, or glue in the cheese, or glue as some part of it. I think, glue the cheese on the pizza is how you do it.
Yeah. And I just, for people who are curious about a subject, you're kind of an expert on curiosity turning into a kind of expertise. How do you recommend people do their own research? How did they separate out what's good information from bad?
Well, that is a great question. I actually just
it in a very self-serving manner.
Well, I think about it all the time, so I want to hear your thoughts too. I'll give you my thoughts, because I actually just did write about this for my Substack, because I have to have one of those now. And it's called Experimental Living with A.D. Jacobs, and it was 10. I was going to call it 10 Commandments for Negotiating the Age of Disinformation and Misinformation. But I don't believe in commandments, because everything should be probabilistic. So I said 10 strong suggestions. And I'll just give you three, but you can check out the others. One is, I do believe in experts, but not a single expert. Because a single expert, you can find a single expert to say anything that basically will make you live forever. Yeah. So look at what, sort of like Rotten Tomatoes, but of science. Look at what the majority of scientists are saying. It's not always perfect, but it is a good. Look for sources that admit they're wrong. There, if you have a source that is always right or refused, you know, that's trouble. That is trouble. So I am always proud, not proud, but I'm always very adamant about saying I was wrong about this. This was incorrect. Let me correct it on the record. And if people don't do that, then don't trust them. And I guess another thing is, yeah, don't look for people who predict things in black and white and say, we are going into a depression in 2026, 100%. No, that's not the way life works. No one can predict things 100%. People who say, you know, there's a 60% chance this would happen, and here is why, I am much more open to listening to them. So just, those are just three to keep in mind. What about you? What are some of your tricks?
I very much agree with your first point about consensus. Is there some kind of consensus in the community? But I also tell people oftentimes to see if the expert in question has a financially vested interest in getting you to believe a certain way, or to getting you to believe in them, period. Like, I've seen a number of folks pop up on social media just in the last year as we're entering a political season, telling people, you know, oh, you can't trust the mainstream media, but you can trust me here. Subscribe to my whatever for $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever, whatever. And it's like, okay, well, I don't know that I... don't know about that. Because who are you and why should I be trusting you and what have you done to get me to buy in? But yeah, I usually tell people if they have a financially vested interest in getting you to believe in a certain way, I would at least, that's at least a bit of a red flag.
That is a wonderful piece of advice. Yes. And I'm going to keep that in mind even more than I do. Yeah. Love that.
When have you felt most challenged in your research, just over your many projects? Is there anything that has ever like really tested you, you know, deep down?
Oh, yeah. I think in all of the projects, I've been tested deep down. I mean, one was when I took on the Bible. Part of the reason I did that was because I grew up in a very secular home, and I was genuinely baffled by why so many smart people were religious, because to me, it did seem like the tooth fairy. And I am still agnostic, but I have now, it did challenge me and change my worldview, because now I don't see religion as black and white. I say that, you know, there are some wonderful parts to religion, community, and the rituals can be beautiful, and it can induce you to act in a more moral way, like abolition was driven by religion. But at the same time, it can be horrible. And fundamentalism is one of the huge scourges of our world. So, but it was a challenge, because it's like, you know, it's easy to see the world in black and white, religion bad or religion good, secularism bad. But no, that's not the way. But it's a challenge because it's complicated.
You're not alone in that thinking. That, you know, my last book, the Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, which talked to people in who wanted to create a version of their own spiritual life that was sort of free from religious dogma and informed by the politics of the day that they were seeing, you know, was really talking to like spiritual dabblers, those spiritual nuns, people who say that they're spiritual but not religious, which as of January of this year is now the number one religious group in America. We've seen that slow, when your book, The Year of Living Biblically, came out, Christianity was far and away. It had been on a slight decline, but was far and away the number one religion in the US. And now it's number two.
Wow. That is a great fact. I didn't know. And also, I like your use of the word dabbler. I like the term dilettante, because dilettante, the root of the word, unless I'm mistaken, is delight. It was originally like people who delighted in, and now it has sort of a negative connotation. But no, you know, be a dilettante, explore different avenues, explore all sorts of different, go deep, but also go broad. And so, yeah, I am a fan of dilettantism and somewhat dabbling, as long as it's not dangerous dabbling.
Is there a topic that you almost did, but you didn't? Is there a topic you've shied away from?
Oh, well, sure. Many. I mean, first of all, we were talking about misinformation and disinformation. I thought a lot about that, because I actually had a book contract to write a book called My Fact-Checked Life was the tentative title. And I was going to fact-check everything in my life. How do I know that the
Did that get a Publisher's Weekly announcement? Because I could have sworn I saw some kind of note or something publicly. But I could have sworn I remember being excited about that. But maybe that wasn't you. Maybe that was somebody else.
Yeah, well, I never finished it. I may go back to it, but I was overwhelmed because it was such a complicated topic, and I wasn't 100% sure I could do it justice. But maybe now I have a little more experience. So anyway, that was one. I get
what
a lot
would that
of
have looked like. Could I ask? Since it's
of
since
course.
It didn't...
Yeah, my plan was tentatively like a chapter. I would have a chapter on, you know, how do I know that the world is round? You know, all the scientists tell me it's round, but
oh God! Well, that's like you're doing 10 separate books, but each book is a chapter instead.
There you go. Exactly.
That's rough.
Right. How do I know my wife loves me? She says she loves me, but you can never be inside someone else's mind. That's the problem of other minds. So, you know, it would range.
I thought it would just be taking like the stuff that we see on a daily basis. Like, how do I know that the weatherman is telling me the truth? How do I know that?
That was a chapter too, the weatherman. Yeah.
Oh man, but how does my how do I know my wife loves me? That is such a bit. Oh God. That would run away from you.
Oh yeah. How do I know 1 + 1 = 2? Because there are philosophers who argue that
who say that sometimes it isn't. Yeah.
Oh, 1 + 1 = 3, like if it adds up to more.
Yeah, sometimes 1 + 1 isn't 2. I've seen people argue that. Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
Can I ask, so you've covered a lot of different topics, and some people might call you an expert in each of these topics, but you are so quick to give away credit and to, you know, again, restate that your own qualifications are as a curious person who is trying to kind of inform yourself and dive deep experimentally into these things. So I'm curious, you've talked to a lot of experts. You've talked to a lot of supposed experts. What do you think makes someone an expert in a subject?
That's a great question. First of all, I'm going to have to think about it, but so I'll try to vamp here for 30 seconds while I come up with some. I mean, part of it is I do think that humility we talked about and saying and willingness to change your mind if the evidence shows otherwise, because that is that's the beauty of science, is that a good scientist will change his or her mind. Mm-hmm. And if presented with the evidence, they're not so in love with the hypothesis. So that's one. I guess also, I feel a good expert has some idea of context. So like, and I'm trying to think of a good example, and I'm totally failing, but maybe it's something like, you know, you can be an expert on shark attacks, and they are fascinating, shark attacks. But if you look at the statistics, you know, shark attacks, they're becoming more common because of global warming, but they're still incredibly rare. And so to have a little bit of perspective that, you know, shark attacks are interesting, but, you know, whatever, 50,000
An understanding of where your expertise fits in with the grand scheme of knowledge and its importance and kind of the hierarchy.
You said it much better than me. Thank you. That was exactly what I was trying to get across, and I couldn't figure out how to say it. So there you go. Yes. And realize, yeah, like, you know, millions of people die from heart disease. So, you know, shark attacks are interesting, but let's keep it in perspective.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
You know, I first read The Know-It-All my freshman year in college. It taught me that I was allowed to ask big questions about even bigger subjects. You know, you're the first two books of yours that I read were taking on the difference between knowledge versus wisdom. Does just simply knowing a lot of things equate to a sense of wisdom? And then you went on to tackle the Bible, and you taught me that I was allowed to ask questions about my upbringing and to come to my own conclusions about those after diligent research. So I'm curious, you've had some time since that book came out. What is knowledge versus what is wisdom? Do you have any new thoughts on that subject now, having, you know?
Yeah. Well, first of all,
researched and written so many new subjects.
Well, yeah. First of all, thank you for what you just said. What a lovely, I mean, that literally chills. You gave me chills that it had a nice impact on you, and that is more than I could hope for. So thank you. And then second, yes. I wasn't just vamping to try to come up with an answer. I genuinely wanted to thank you. But as for knowledge and wisdom, part of it is what we were just talking about context, looking at the big context and trying to say where I fit in. I do have a phrase that I picked up that I that I heard after the book came out, so I couldn't use it, which was, knowledge is knowing that tomatoes are a fruit, and wisdom is knowing that they don't belong in a fruit salad.
Yes.
So that is a cue. But however, like with everything, let's delve deep into that. Why not? Why can't tomatoes be in a fruit salad? I say, you know, we don't have to submit to the dogma of the fruit people who say that tomatoes can't be in there. Anyway, that the point is, I guess, perspective, where the knowledge fits in. So like we said with the sharks, you know, that is fascinating, but how does it fit into the big picture of humanity? And looking outside of yourself, maybe that's a big part of wisdom. I think, like, one of the things that I've realized more and more is that in one of the best ways to be fulfilled and to be happy is to think of others' happiness, which is kind of paradoxical. You would think pursuing your own happiness would be the one that makes you happy, but weirdly, we are built by evolution to help others. And so helping others achieve their happiness actually is very good for your own happiness, which is a great thing. I thank evolution for that. Thank you for making that such a nice coincidence.
Yeah, we are social creatures, and we've found, you know, over the time we've been studying it, at least, that when the collective good is met, we tend to do better.
Right.
You know, I want to allow for the exceptions of outliers and disabled folks and folks in the minorities. And I don't think anybody listening to me or that knows my platform would think that I'm talking about that. But what I'm saying is that when we watch out for our fellow man, our own happiness and our general society tends to get better, which again is kind of just, I'm on that wavelength because that's what I'm currently researching.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Well, I can't wait to read your new work. That sounds amazing.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. I don't know that I want AJ Jacobs to ever read anything I write, because I would fall into a hole somewhere if you knew that I existed, which it's you.
It's too late. I know you exist, and I'm excited and curious about your work. And yeah, I can't. So where are you in that process?
Thankfully, I just handed back edits on my novel, so I'm meeting with my editor, my new editor, for this, my second nonfiction book, next
Wonderful.
Monday, apparently. So I only have a couple of chapters written, but we are on the way. So
you are very prolific. I am super impressed.
Well, I have to keep up with folks like you.
Well, I feel the opposite. I have to keep up with folks like you.
Is there a big question you haven't tackled that you want to?
That is a great question. Well, we were talking earlier about emotions, and I would love to dive deep into emotions and what, how they're helpful and how they're not, because like everything, they are good in some ways and not so good in others. And I can't wait to read yours about emotions, but yeah, I find it fascinating. I mean, my gut, I don't know if this is my gut, actually, let me rephrase that. What one of my beliefs is that some emotions are mostly good, like gratitude, joy, curiosity, and some emotions are mostly bad. And I would put anger in there. I know that makes you more productive now. I know that. But
I'll send you that research in the interview. You're going to love it, I think.
I would definitely want to see some pro anger. Because yes, I agree, it has its positives. But I would say on the whole, if I were on the Rotten Tomatoes score, I would put it at 40% as opposed to curiosity, which I would put it like, 95%.
Your wife, Julie, shares some aspects with my husband, because unfortunately they married writers who do crazy things like write nonfiction books for people about big, big, scary topics. So is your wife a saint? Because you have put her through a lot of experiments. Is she, Is she in the running for living sainthood?
I think Judaism does have saints in some branch. So maybe she's very patient. I do want to hear about your husband, but first, she is, just to throw one example for people who haven't read my books, with the Bible, I was really trying to follow Leviticus. So Leviticus says you cannot touch women when they're menstruating. I suggested it. I didn't actually build the tent, but I did. The other thing is Leviticus says, if you sit in a seat, like women will pollute the seat while if they sit in it while they're menstruating. And so you can't. So she was offended and sat in every seat in our apartment while she was menstruating. So I had to stand for the whole time.
Which and then you I ended later up buying found, a stool. A little, I did. A little pop-up stool thing.
Right. I have my own island of purity. I had a little, I think it might even be in this closet somewhere.
Do you still have the stool?
Oh, sure. I could never
good.
Get rid of the stool.
I'm so glad the stool is real and still exists.
Absolutely.
But she's also seems to be very game for some parts of the experiment. I mean, obviously, you know, you seem to have, really found a good match because she goes with you. I mean, she went to hand out election cake. She dressed up in Alexander Hamilton gear. She put you in the stocks for 5 minutes.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Sometimes she will just be totally game.
But she didn't let you do the leeches. So that was...
She shut me down on leeches and a few other things. So she has her limits. She didn't love when we...
Has there been something you wanted to do for a bit for your books that she put the kibosh on that you're just a little bitter about? Don't worry, she'll never listen to this.
Oh, yeah, she puts the kibosh on tons, like the leeches. I mean, there was one experiment where I videotaped every moment of my life for like a month. And it was a long time ago. It was like, but I had a tiny little camera. And the idea was maybe I could, you know, if we get in an argument, a lot of times with the spouse, the argument is, you never told me that. So now I can be, well, let's go back. And we got in one. We don't fight all that much screaming fights, but we did get in one screaming fight about something ridiculous about whether she had told me to order.
AJ Jacobs, you did not pull up the tape.
Well, not only did I pull up the tape, which was terrible, but then the Today Show wanted to do a segment on it. And they're like, we really want to show that segment of her screaming at you. And she was like, absolutely not. So yeah, that she put, which is good. Like that wouldn't have been good for me.
That would have been a divorce, right? That would have been, that would have been the year of marriage counseling. That would have been.
I like that idea. Now, what is your husband? Tell me one something that he has.
Oh gosh. Well, in my last book, I did a chapter on, what's called UPG, unverified or unsubstantiated personal gnosis. Stuff about like ghost hunting and stuff. Like he really loves ghost hunting. And so, you know, I've talked a little bit about him in regards to belief in spirits and ghosts and his relationship with that. I've been kind of subtly, slowly working on a book about death and dying. And he died once. Don't what? Worry, it got better. But yeah, so he's in that. He was in a car accident. You can't see the time, he has a small scar in the shape of a letter C on the right side of his head. So yeah, he died for a little while. So he'll tell me what it was like on the other side. But it's, talking about, some of the research with people that have NDE near-death experiences. It's just interesting to see how his NDE has correlated with the life changes that other people made after an NDE. And, like a lot of people stop having a fear of death after experiencing an NDE. And he's the same in that regard.
Oh, really?
The book about loneliness, I don't know. He's not as interested in that one. Does Julie read your books? He doesn't really read mine. I will say when I publish a new book, he's like, okay, well, which parts have me in them? But he doesn't want to read them until the book is done.
Hilarious. Well, I to avoid the year of marriage counseling, I make her read everything even the parts without her, because what if I say something ridiculous?
Yeah, he just kind of assumes that I'm going to behave, I guess.
Well, that is fascinating.
Or that he just doesn't care. He's like yeah. Nobody's, you know, I don't put him on social media or anything, so I don't think he's too worried about people coming up to him on the street and saying, hey, aren't you that guy from chapter 10?
So now, for the loneliness book, are you going to have to send him away for a month so you can experience true loneliness?
You know, I wasn't going to, but that's maybe. An idea.
Well, it might not,
it's not
be
a
fun.
Bad one either.
I don't want to be responsible if it causes any misery. But yeah, go ahead.
Have you ever won a game of Trivial Pursuit against your brother-in-law?
That's a great question. And for those who haven't read that book on the encyclopedia, he was sort of my nemesis. He went to Harvard and he knows everything. But I will say one of the great moments of that book and experience was I was on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and he was my lifeline, and he didn't get the question. So he national television, but I also brought him down with me. So that was, but no, he is still superior at Trivial Pursuit. I mean, his mind is just really good with facts. It's amazing. And even if he doesn't know something, then he says it in a way that makes you believe he does.
Well, AJ Jacobs, it has been the treat of a lifetime to get to speak with you today. I'm so appreciative of your time. For folks who want to get a little bit more of the AJ Jacobs experience, the book is The Year of Living Constitutionally. And where else can people find you online?
AJJacobs.com, and that Substack is Experimental Living with AJ Jacobs, and it's mostly free. I mean, you get almost everything. But Don, it was just a delight to talk to you, and I can't wait to keep in touch and follow your work. And I want to read what you write about loneliness and everything else.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And that is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest and literary hero, AJ Jacobs. His new book, The Year of Living Constitutionally, is available wherever books are sold. Now, back to me for a second. If you like the show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. The easiest and freest way is just telling your friends, either in person or on social media, that you like this show. That organic word of mouth is the easiest and best way of helping me grow this audience. If you want to do a little bit more, you could like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever app you're using. And while you're there, consider leaving a review. Literally any combination of words or emojis tells the algorithm to recommend the show to other listeners like you. Now, if you want to do a little bit more, you can join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional ad-free audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private chat with me, and you all, the Patreon supporters, will be the first people to see stuff like the new cover for Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire, my upcoming debut YA fantasy novel, or to read chunks of Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire. You will also be the first people to know about my next nonfiction book that I kind of hinted about here during the interview with AJ Jacobs that I can't legally talk about just yet. But if you want early access to any of that, you can join my Patreon at patreon.com/headonfirepod. If you just want the book updates and all of the early access to that, I made a free tier just for you. If you sign up for the free tier on Patreon, you will get access to like pre-order stuff, early book content, and all of that. So patreon.com/headonfirepod. I want this to be accessible as possible for everybody. You can also find me on social media. I am at headonfirepod on all platforms, and you can email me contact@headonfirepod.com. I'm going to go because I've talked too much. But, you know, I'm going to tell you to never stop seeking illumination like an AJ Jacobs with his head on fire seeks water. Be well.